If in the land of Israel they were to have license plates like ours in Minnesota, they would say on them, in Hebrew of course, the land of one lake, because that's what they have, although they have three different names for that one lake. It has been variously called the Lake of Gennesaret, the Sea of Tiberias, or the Sea of Galilee. But whatever you call it, it has to be considered one of the strangest lakes in all the world. Not particularly large. It's 15 miles by about 6 miles, so there's about, I think, 650 square miles or something like that of surface area. I suppose if you were to make a very rough comparison, you would say it's sort of a cross between Lake Mille Lacs. It sort of has that shape to it, very open, not a lot of bays, and Lake Minnetonka in terms of proportions or length and width. Even though it's very small in size, it's surprisingly deep, typically the depth ranging from around 120 to 155 feet. It's fresh water, even though it's called a sea. Actually, that's a very strange name for such a comparatively small freshwater lake. It is bordered by mountains, which makes it very picturesque, but also makes it very prone to violence. Tumultuous, life-threatening storms can quickly whip into Galilee. But perhaps most unusual of all is that the surface of the Sea of Galilee is 650 feet below sea level, which makes it almost a tropical climate there, in a place that, of course, is not in the tropics. Well, I'd like to have you imagine it, being there as best you can. And as long as you have your imagination going, I would like you to get into your imaginary fishing boat, because we're going fishing this morning with Jesus. Our fishing story begins on page 1597. It's Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. And the fish story goes like this. One day, as Jesus was standing by the Lake of Gennesaret, with the people crowding around him and listening to the word of God, he saw at the water's edge two boats left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little from shore. Then he sat down and taught the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything. But because you say so, I will let down the nets." When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them, and they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me. Lord, I'm a sinful man." For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were Simon's partners. Then Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will catch men." So they pulled their boats up on shore, left everything, and followed him. It's a great fish story. Jesus gave these guys some wonderful pointers on fishing, but in the course of doing that, he also gave to us some wonderful pointers on living. The first of them is rather common, actually, woven through the fabric of the first four verses of Luke 5. It is that Jesus begins great works with ordinary things. And let me tell you, this was a rather ordinary day. You read the first four verses here, and it's not a whole lot like reading the rest of the stories of Jesus in the New Testament, that he talked to people, he taught them, and not much said here about what he actually taught. But that particular day, he was hard to hear. And the people that were close, that were pressed around him, all around, they could hear what he had to say, at least the ones in front. But you've been in a situation like that, where you're trying to listen to someone and the people up close can hear very well, but if you're the second or the third or certainly the 50th back, You can hardly make out a single word that's being said, and there's a temptation to talk to the other people and say, what did he say? But then when everybody starts doing that and whispering and muttering back and forth, it makes it harder for the people who are around to hear. And Jesus noticed that there were two fishing boats over by the shoreline, and they weren't being used. The fishermen were cleaning their nets, and so Jesus walked over, stepped into the water, and did what teachers did in those days. He sat down, because teachers sat when they taught. And from the edge of the boat, he talked to them. And now he could be heard fine, because he was out a few feet into the lake, and he could project, and they weren't crowded tight around him. It was a rather ordinary day, a rather ordinary thing to do. Pretty typical of the way things were then. What do you think could have imagined that that day would be a turning point, a transformation, not only in the lives of those people, but in the history of the world? That there, that day, Jesus would take the ordinary and he would do the spectacular. That those who started out as fishermen would end up being apostles, and that they would take out on an adventure that eventually would impact the population of the world and all of history for all of eternity. It seems to me that when we're looking for God, we are often prone to look for the spectacular. You know, the loud voice or the brilliant light that comes from the sky. And yet, it is far more typical of God to work in the ordinary things of life. The simple days, the everyday occurrences. That it's on a Sunday morning that otherwise probably wouldn't be distinguished from any others, or it's Monday going to school on the bus, or it's Tuesday coming home from work, or it's Wednesday in an appointment that's been scheduled for a long time that was a pretty ordinary appointment. And there in the midst of the ordinary circumstances of life, God intervenes and God does something that makes a huge difference, for he is the God not only of the spectacular, but far more often the God who does his great works through ordinary things. It ties into a second pointer on living that Jesus offers in verse 5, where it's explained to us that circumstances are a big thing in our culture, in our society. We talk a lot about circumstances, how they may seem all wrong for what Jesus asks us to do, because at least in this case, it was a most unlikely time, most unlikely, to ask what he asked. You see, when he finished his teaching, he asked them to push out farther into the lake, row into the deep water, and there to cast their nets. But Simon, also called Peter, he knew that was a bad idea. After all, in those days, in fact today, most all the fishing that's done on Galilee is done at nighttime. Professional fishermen don't fish during daylight hours, and it was morning. Not only that, but they already tried and it didn't work. And experienced fishermen will tell you that when they're not biting, they're not biting. If they're not biting anywhere in the lake, going back an hour later isn't going to make them bite. They hadn't caught a minnow all night, and it was just a futile effort. Besides, Peter and his partners, for they were in a business together, they were professional fishermen. They had grown up with it. They knew the trade well. They were very good at it. They knew fish. Jesus was a carpenter. He knew wood. What did he have to say to them? It was a waste of time. And if for no other reason, they were tired. They had been up all night long. They had worked hard. And you know well that when you really try to do something, often it's not just the physical exertion, but it's the emotional drain, especially when it doesn't come together the way you want it to. And they were drained. And in a situation like that, we're not at our best. Someone might fall overboard, or if a storm were to suddenly come across the horizon and to catch them far from shore, they wouldn't be at their sharpest and able to deal with the dilemma. And so they must have thought, if in fact they did not say, bad timing, Jesus, bad timing for this. But they didn't know that Jesus does some of his best miracles at the most unlikely times. That Jesus chooses to overrule circumstances or to work through them rather than conform to them. It's a lesson for us to learn. Because we are so prone to want all of the circumstances to fall into place,
for the timing to be exactly right, for everything like a funnel that we would imagine to bring everything in life together so now is the right time for the right thing to happen that God wants to do. But that's not the way God usually operates. God doesn't wait for good circumstances. Often he prefers the bad circumstances, the most unlikely of times. And so he speaks his word, he reaches out and he touches our lives when we are far too busy for his word or for his touch. When we're far too tired, when we're far too consumed with everything else, at the times when we know far better than we think he knows what ought to be done and how it ought to be done. But let us never then tell Jesus that the time isn't very good for this. The time isn't quite right. Because the truth is that any time for what he wants to do is the best time. And we ought to learn, at least from their story, to take the circumstances and just hang them up and go with what Jesus seeks to do within our lives, that he is the Christ of circumstance and that he may be ready to do his greatest work at our least convenient time. That ties into a third pointer that's also in verse 5. Simon's answer to Jesus' request has to be one of the best lines in the Bible. He said, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything, but because you say so, I will let down the nets." Just, Jesus, because you say so. My first car was a 1941 Plymouth Coupe that cost $55. And if you think that's a very good price, it is, except the car's brakes didn't work. So it would go, it just wouldn't stop. And I got it home. I was 14, and now, from the vantage point of my age and experience, I can't believe my parents let me do that. If they then would check with me now, they would get different advice than they got from their son at 14. But I talked to somebody and said, "Well, what do I have to do to fix the brakes?" And this guy explained to me, I knew nothing, I mean nothing, about hydraulic brakes. He explained to me a little bit about how it works, and he gave me a motor manual, a book. So I sat out in the garage floor, I borrowed a wheel puller, and I pulled the brake drums and disconnected the lines and took out the shoes, and the pistons and the cylinders were jammed. They were rusted in place. And hammered them out, and I got these kits to rebuild the brake cylinders and put new fluid in the line and purged it. And lo and behold, really, to my amazement, I think as much as anyone else's, the brakes worked. But then it wouldn't start. So I turned to another part of the book and started working on the engine. I put in new points and checked the timing, and I did everything I could. Put in new spark plug wires and tried to jumpstart. I ran the battery down, tried to use booster cables. I mean, it would turn over, but it just wouldn't start. And then one day when I just about given up, had the car in the garage, which wasn't totally to my father's happiness, and he walked out, he was on his way somewhere, and his car was in the driveway, and he walked by, and he just looked under the hood, and he said, "Why don't you connect the ground wire to the distributor?" Now, I don't remember exactly what I thought, but I remember being 14, so pretty good idea what I thought. He knew nothing about cars. I was surprised he could drive one. I'm sure I thought to myself, "Dad, you know, it's just not as simple as that. Besides, I've got the book. I mean, I've read the book. And so, obviously, I know a whole lot more than you know." And, I mean, I knew I was right, and I knew he was wrong. And, frankly, I just didn't feel like bothering. But out of respect for my father, I did what he asked me to do. And it started. It was like Peter. "Jesus, because of what you say, I will let down the nets." You know, in most of us, if we did what we feel like doing in life, we would never do anything of value. Often we must make a choice between what we feel like doing and what we should do. Often we need to make that key decision. Perhaps you read in yesterday's Minneapolis Star Tribune the article on Albert Einstein. Yesterday, the 14th of March, was his birthday, I think. Had he lived this long, he'd be 113 years old. And it told some interesting things about him and his theory of relativity and his fame and some of his idiosyncrasies. It did have a column there, all boxed in, that told about some of his hobbies. Among them, that he liked to play the violin. And maybe you read that, but perhaps you do not know that he really wanted to be a concert violinist. That's what he felt like doing with his life. In fact, Einstein, they say, practiced for hours every day. He just wasn't quite as good at that as he was at physics and at math. And so he was smart enough, Einstein was, to make the choice to do what he should do instead of what he felt like doing. And if the article is right, they say that there may have never been, nor will ever be, a mathematician or physicist as bright as he, that he was able to figure out the theory of relativity in his mind because he did what he should do, rather than what he felt like doing. It's another Jesus lesson for us to learn and to live, that the key choices of life are often between what we feel like doing and what should be done. It ties in to a fourth pointer for living that Jesus gives to us in verses 4 through 7. It's the lesson that obedience brings results. Jesus, here he spoke this word, and these fishermen obeyed, and the results were abnormally abundant. When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break, and so they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them, and they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. You know what a big catch means for fishermen. It means prosperity. It means success. It means money. That was their livelihood. I suppose you would say that that would be like a profit, a huge profit, an unexpected profit for someone in business. Or it would be like making it to the championship game for someone who is a professional athlete. Or it would be like a politician who wins the election. Or an author who is not only published but makes the bestseller list. Well, here the lesson is simple, that obedience to Jesus brings results. Not always these results, but always good results. And you know, those who don't obey never experience that, do they? And those who do obey are never sorry with the results that Jesus gives. Now, in some ways, it's very hard to understand why we are so reluctant to obey what Jesus asks us to do, for often we are. I mean, if you had a financial advisor who was always right, every investment you made with her always ended up paying off and paying off big. With that kind of track record, wouldn't you expect that the next prediction probably would be a good one? What Jesus asks of us always brings good results. You would think we would learn from that. That we would quit trying to get our own results through disobedience and go for his results through doing what he asks. Which brings us to a fifth point around living. It's in verses 8 through 10. It has to do with Peter's realizing who Jesus was. And that enabled him to recognize who he was. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man." Because he and his friends were astonished, is the word that's used, astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken. They had never seen anything like it in all of their lives, and Peter and the others were just awestruck, not just by the number of fish, but by the realization of who Jesus was, that he knew things that they didn't know and never would know, that he had powers that were far beyond anything they had ever experienced. That he was, Peter began to realize it, that Jesus was God. And in his presence, Peter was scared. At first glance, we think it rather strange that someone would so speak to Jesus in the aftermath of a miracle and say, "Go away from me, I am a sinful man." But you know, we all tend to think we're okay. Some of us think we're pretty great until we stand next to someone who who is far greater. And it is then that we recognize that we are not quite what we thought ourselves to be. It was now a long time ago, I think 14, maybe 15 years ago, that I was invited by a Wooddaler to play racquetball at a private racquetball club in St. Paul. And this wasn't a health club that had racquetball courts. This was just racquetball. And these are people that were really serious about it. And I think at the time he was rated number one on the ladder in that club. I got there, increasingly questioning my judgment on being there, and he made an offer. He said, "Leif, why don't we play to 21, and I'll spot you 18 points. He also said, "If you can't return my serve, I'll take it over. I won't count that as a score." And I said, "Oh, none of this is necessary." Well, it wasn't a very long game. When it was over, I was soaked with sweat. I was so exhausted, I was ready to collapse on the floor. He was not sweating. He was not the least bit out of breath. And the final score was he had 21 and I 18. And after the game was over, I didn't ever want to see him again for the rest of my life. And it wasn't just that he was so good, but that he made me look so bad. I mean, up until then, I didn't know how bad I was. I think that's a lot of the way Peter felt that day. He was astonished. He was awestruck at Jesus and what he could do and who he was. He realized how good Jesus was, which made Peter recognize how bad Peter was. Now, frankly, that's part of becoming a Christian. Becoming a Christian is seeing Jesus as he is, that he is God, and that he is good, he is brilliant, he is righteous and powerful and wise, that he is perfect. And when we see him as he is, we see ourselves as we are. Up against him, we see our sin, we see our stupidity. We see our weakness, and we see our wickedness. And for many of us, the first response is to say to Jesus, "Get out of here. Get away from me." Because we don't want to look so bad by comparison. And so we ask him to get out of comparison's sight. But Jesus has a better way. It is his sixth pointer for living. For that day, seeing Peter's fear, Jesus said to him, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. From now on, you will catch men." What Jesus literally said was, "Stop being afraid." He acknowledged that they were afraid. Jesus had and has a wonderful sensitivity about him, where he, unlike many others, reads well the emotions, the feelings, the fears of those whom he knows. And so he speaks a word of comfort, a word to chase the fears away. But Jesus gave more than a word. He gave also a call to service. He asked them to do something. Ask them to do something in part as a means to chase that fear away, but also as a means for these fishermen to become disciples, to experience the ongoing presence and power of Jesus for the rest of their lives, the way they had that day while fishing out on Galilee. What he did was he called them into service as men catchers. He asked them to go beyond catching fish, and he wanted them to make the number one priority of their lives, recruiting people for heaven. We call it evangelism. It is convincing men and women to become disciples of Jesus Christ, to have their sins forgiven and to have their lives transformed and to be given a guarantee of forever in heaven. And when you think about that, what would any of us best like at the end of our lives? To have a list of all the fish that we caught on Minnesota lakes? Or to have a list of all the people that we had recruited out of the clutches of hell and into the promises and the pleasures of heaven? Understand that this is what the Church of Jesus Christ, this is what this church is all about. We're people catchers. I know, as often as it is explained, there are some that have difficulty really understanding what the essence of the church is. But let it be said again that we are not here to be entertained, and we are not here to entertain. We have not become a church in order to build a building, or to give to me a job, or to make for ourselves friends. We exist to make disciples for Jesus Christ, so that every program, every building, everything that we are about is to be targeted on that single goal of people catching. And in the process of it, we are never satisfied. If we get one, we want two. Get 1,000 and we want 10,000. No matter how many, there are never enough, because we have been called by Jesus Christ to recruit men and women to be his disciples for now, forever. We need to understand that the Church of Jesus Christ was never designed nor intended to be a cruise ship for pleasure, that it is rather a fishing boat for people. And that, like Simon, who here is listed with his partners of James and John, we too are partners, partners together. Those who have heard and answered the call of Jesus Christ out of fear and into the service of people catching. It leads to a seventh and a final pointer. These veteran fishermen did a most extraordinary thing. The story ends saying that they pulled their boats up on shore, left everything, and followed him. You know, these boats were their livelihood. They may have still owed money on them. And here they had the biggest catch that they had ever seen in their lives, maybe the biggest catch ever recorded in the history of all of Galilee. And they were going to walk away from it. At the very time that you would think that they would be taking the fish to market, I mean, the shelf life of fish is not very long. They had, at best, a few hours to make the biggest amount of money ever. Time was of the essence, and delay would be a disaster. And they left everything. That would compare to someone making a livelihood off investing money, buying a stock low, having it split once or twice, have it multiply 10 times or 100 times and skyrocket far beyond anything anyone had ever anticipated, and then to walk away from it. It would be like an athlete who had prepared a lifetime all the way up to the championship game and then not show up. Or a politician working and campaigning and winning the election and never taking office. Why would anyone do such a thing? Simply, one would do such a thing in order to follow Jesus. It was clear to them. Following Jesus was better. Better than the biggest catch in all of history. It was clear to them that following Jesus is always better than anything else. And when we have really seen Jesus, and when we have really decided to follow him, then for us too, the comparison is clear. Oh, it's not to say that following Jesus always means abandoning our boats or leaving our nets or some large catch behind. But it is saying that following Jesus always means that he is more important than anything else in life. And it's also saying that making disciples is far better than making money. Do you fish? If you're a fisher person, then when someone who is a super fisherman gives you some really great pointers on how to do it, there's only one thing to do with those pointers, and that's go fishing. And when Jesus gives us seven living pointers, there's only one thing to do with them, and that's for us to go and live.
Yes, I do want to share with you ever so briefly this morning a ministry that my family and myself have been called to. Hospitality House is a Christian boys and girls club that services both North and South Minneapolis. Certainly, we are all aware of, through the media today, that life in the city is tough. In fact, we hear regular reports of homicides and theft and drive-by shootings, death threats, young people being taken hostage during bad drug deals, arson, bombings, sophisticated weaponry being used on the streets, this rapid spread of youth gangs, unemployment, broken homes, the list goes on. And even as I consider these particular elements, I realize that these are a reality in the neighborhood that my family lives in, and also in the communities of the young people that we serve. As I reflect on this city today, I'm reminded of a passage in the Old Testament where God himself is looking down and reflecting on the sins of Jerusalem. And then in Ezekiel chapter 22, verse 30, we read these words, "I looked for a man among them who would build up the wall and stand before me in the gap on behalf of the land, so I would not destroy it, but I found none." In Jerusalem's case, when God looked, he found no one. In Minneapolis's case, we want to be found faithful in rebuilding what has been broken and to stand in the gap for each of those young people that we serve. Our strategy as a ministry is quite simple. First, we go where kids are at. We go into the schools. We go into the parks. We go into the streets where they hang out. We'll go to the malls and the shopping centers. We go and we find kids. And as we find those young people, we begin to build relationships with them, and we offer them safe and structured activities that are of interest to them. And then most importantly, all that we do and all that we say, we want to be Christ-centered. And our staff recognize the extreme importance of them modeling Christ to each of the young people that they have relationship with. You know, God's final question to Jonah about the city of Nineveh is the same question that God would pose for us for the city of Minneapolis. Should I not be concerned about that great city? And the answer is obvious. Yes, God is deeply concerned about Minneapolis, and so are we. And as a ministry, we are especially concerned about kids like Taisha and Michi and Natasha and Charles and Mohammed and Kawana, Jamil, and the list goes on and on. There's a simple saying, "I know I'm somebody because God don't make no junk." Well, you know, that statement is very true. But the difficult thing is that for many of the youth that we serve, they don't feel that, and they don't experience that in their life. And so they're position is one that makes them feel more like they're trash. But you know, the exciting thing is that the gospel provides hope to the hopeless. the message of salvation raises up new creations. So the question to us as a ministry is, are we making a difference in the city of Minneapolis? And I want to share with you just one quick example. This past week, we as an organization, in cooperation with another organization called Twin Cities Against Drug and Violence, sponsored Joseph Jennings, who's a national youth evangelist, who was converted from the life on the streets and in gangs. And we had him here for 1 week. We had him present assemblies in a number of the junior high schools. And then on Thursday night this past week, we had a youth rally at Falwell Junior High School. And then on Friday night, we had a rally at our own center in North Minneapolis. There were over 700 young people in attendance between both of these rallies. And over 300 came forward to make new commitments or recommitments to Christ in their life. Yes, just as God recognized the repentant hearts of Nineveh and spared their lives, He still provides salvation to any person who turns to Him. Now, before I close, I would really be remiss in my duties if I didn't give a word of thanks to you as a church for your support of our ministry this past year. And at the same time, I also trust and pray that as we push into the future, that our relationship will only grow stronger and deeper as the weeks and the months and the years ahead unfold. Thank you very much.